Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for October's Orthopaedics Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, RCVS Recognised Specialist in Small Animal Surgery Orthopaedics, Turlough O'Neill. Thank you, Turlough. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for listening. We're going to look at one of the more common difficulties that we see in orthopaedic surgery. Not just a single problem of medial patellar luxation, but what do you do when you get concurrent cranial cruciate ligament rupture and medial patellar luxation? We're going to confine ourselves to the dog because that's where most of our experience is. I can't say I've ever seen it in a cat, but I'm sure it can happen. So basically, we should get started and see what we get to. So if we look at patellar luxation, so we're going to basically consider them individually first and then consider how we can combine our surgeries or how we can adjust our surgeries to suit both conditions. So if we look at medial patellar luxation, basically the patella is a sesamoid in the tendon of the quadriceps femoris muscle. Basically, where the quadriceps femoris passes over the end of the femur, the distal femur, we get tension on the tendon. The body has developed a sesamoid bone to grow in here. With the sesamoid, we've got cartilage on the back of the bone, we've got cartilage in the trochlear groove. This allows frictionless motion as much as we can. Second part to look at is the femoral trochlea. The word trochlea means pulley in Latin. So basically, what it is, it's a groove that acts like a pulley. The third thing we've got to think about is what we refer to as the extensor apparatus. And we're going to talk about this a lot more later on, because I think it's going to be very important when we look at the combined condition. So the extensor apparatus basically involves a number of pieces. You've got the quadriceps muscle. You also have the rectus femoris coming from the rectus femoris tuberosity on the ventral part of the ilium. We then get the quadriceps from the proximal femur, and then you get the straight patellar ligament slash tendon to the tibial tuberosity. So the whole thing extends from the ventral wing of the ilium, from the proximal femur, across the trochlea, down to the tibial tuberosity. Always interesting to have a discussion on whether it is the straight patellar ligament or straight patellar tendon. A ligament we generally define as something that travels from one bone to another. A tendon is obviously from a muscle to bone. Because this is a sesamoid, what we actually have here is we've got a tendon around the sides of the sesamoid, but we actually have a ligament from the sesamoid to the tibial tuberosity. You will find that I will use these terms interchangeably without defining the difference between them. So don't panic if you hear me say one minute and the other. They're pretty much interchangeable. We do mean the same structure, basically. So if we look at the epidemiology of medial patellar luxations, people talk about it being congenital or maybe developmental. By definition, congenital means it is present at the time the animal is born. And what we find with medial patellar luxation is, while many of the abnormalities that predispose to medial patellar luxation are present at birth, the patella is not necessarily luxated. So, is it truly congenital? Debatable. Is it developmental? Well, probably. However, if you go back and look at many of the studies, they talk about the most common congenital deformity in the dog. This study, they looked at 124 cases of medial patellar luxation, and they found that 82% were congenital versus acquired, 89% were medial patellar luxations versus lateral patellar luxations, 65% were bilateral, and 35% were unilateral, which is pretty typical of most studies. Another study that looked at the numbers of congenital abnormalities in immature dogs looked at pet stores, and they looked at 1,679 dogs, of which 253 had congenital abnormality. So that's 15% of the congenital abnormality. Of those 253, 121 had patellar luxation. So that's 7.5% of the total population had what they refer to as congenital patellar luxation. Again, 98% of these were small breeds and diagnosed by 6 months of age. If we look at the last study, then again, we're looking at 97% median patella luxations. These were actually looking at large breed dogs. So lateral patella luxations were only 3%. They found a male to female ratio of 1.8 to 1. Again, they're bilateral 65%. So overall, we seem to see it is a relatively common. 7.5% of dogs have got patellar luxation. 97-98% of those are going to have medial patellar luxation. 2-3% are going to have lateral patellar luxation. 65% have got bilateral disease. 35% unilateral disease. Occasionally, we will get iatrogenic patellar luxation. So, if they've had a surgery on the stifle, one of the things are things like TTAs, where you're advancing the tibial tuberosity. The idea being that technically you could medialize that tibial tuberosity. You also elevate the patella out of the trochlea, therefore giving rise to potential possibility for medial patellar luxation. The last group we see are traumatic. These dogs have been perfectly normal. They've been running around the park. They've over-rotated. Patella has forced its way out of the trochlea, causing damage on the way, and they suddenly become lame. So if we look at concurrent medial patellar luxation and cranial cruciate ligament, we find in most studies between 15 and 20% of dogs have got concurrent cranial cruciate ligament when we look at the groupings for the medial patellar luxation. Again, if you look at groupings for medial patellar luxation, we get the neonates, we get the young mature dogs, and then we tend to get the older dogs with acute onset due to degenerative joint disease or erosion of the cartilage or cranial cruciate ligament rupture. So commonly, we find dogs have got patellar luxation. It's been there. It hasn't been a problem. It is only when we get rupture of the cranial cruciate ligament or we get severe erosion of the cartilage that we start to see a problem. And these present as slightly older dogs with acute deterioration. In another study, up to 41% of small breed dogs had both cranial cruciate ligament when they had patellar luxation. So there was 266 dogs with medial patellar luxation. Of those, 162 had cranial cruciate ligament injury. Again, we look at this, the mean age was 7.8 years of age for the combined disease. For the medial patellar luxation alone, we tended to find them at 3 years of age. So again, it seems to suggest that we have neonates with patellar luxation, we have young mature dogs with patellar luxation, and then we tend to have a group of dogs that present for patellar luxation and cranial cruciate ligament at a slightly older age. So if we look at medial patellar luxation, there are a number of musculoskeletal abnormalities that we define as part and parcel of the whole thing. If we start at the top, we start looking at the hip joint. We can tend to have a decreased antiversion, in other words, retroversion. We can have coxavara. We can even have genovalgum, which is the whole bow-legged appearance. And not all of these are present in every dog. In actual fact, there's some debate about the coxavara. There's some debate about the antiversion, retroversion. So, you know, these are the typical things that are seen and reported in dogs with medial patellar luxation. Then the changes in the femur tend to be external rotation of the distal third of the femur, lateral bowing of the distal femur, internal rotation of the proximal tibia. Then we get down to the shallow or absent trochlea. We get a pseudotrochlea on the medial condyle. And these are all explainable by developmental disease. If you take your quadriceps mechanism, if you change your hip angle, it makes your legs start to stick out slightly. You then may find that makes a quadriceps mechanism slightly to the internal aspect of the leg, causing the tibia to be slightly internally rotated. The trochlea also develops because of the patella sitting, and if you take the patella out of the trochlea, it starts to infill. You increase the pressure on the distal femoral growth plate, and you find that decreases the amount of growth in the medial aspect, but increases the growth laterally, causing it to start to have this change of internal rotation. Similarly, we get the opposite happening in the tibia. If you look at the stifle joint itself, again, not surprisingly, the medial trochlear ridge is hypoplastic because there's increased pressure here because the pressure is all on the inside, stopping that from growing properly. You get rotational instability because you've got internal tibial rotation. Femoral and tibial condyles are asymmetrical because the femur has rolled laterally, tibia has rolled medially, so you don't get normal contact. Contracture of the medial capsule, all the soft tissue tightens up, all the lateral tissue stretches. And you get hyaline cartilage erosion and damage, leading to the subpatellar ulceration, the medial ridge ulceration. And then you get a compensatory rotation of the hock with the foot rotating inwards, the point of the ankle rotating outwards. So these are very typical changes we see in most dogs with patellar luxation. Now, all or some may be present in any one individual case. They don't all have to be present, and they can be present at a greater or lesser degree, but they are the typical abnormalities we will see. So if we look back at patellar luxation, over the years we've tried grading these, and back in 1969 Singleton published his grading scheme, and he graded them 1 to 4, and I have to say this grading scheme still holds pretty well to this day, even though we are less of an issue about it, but it is still present. Basically, his grade 1 was a patella that was pretty much in the trochlear groove most of the time, however occasionally luxated. It would reduce on extending the leg, pop straight back in, and would stay there for some time. With grade 2, tends to luxate a lot easier. You get internal rotation of the foot, and the proximal tibia tends to have some internal tibial rotation, so tibial tuberosity tends to sit about 30 degrees medially. With his grade 3, your patella was pretty much permanently luxated, but it was reducible. So it was out, but you could put it back in. Proximal tibia was rotated 30 to 60 degrees, and the stifle was held in a semi-flex position. With grade 4, these were permanently luxatable and non-reducible. Tibial tuberosity tended to be rotated by 60 to 90 degrees. When we look at medial patellar luxations and cranial cruciate ligaments, we find that you can get cranial cruciate ligament in all four grades of patellar luxation. So in the studies, I looked at 72 stifles that had both medial patellar luxation and cranial cruciate ligament injury. We found that 6 of them had grade 1 patellar luxation, 32 had grade 2, 27 had grade 3, and only 7 had grade 4. As you would find, typically the dogs of grade 2 and grade 3 are the most common ones that we see, and they're the ones we treat most commonly as well. So it can happen at all grades, but more commonly middle grades are the ones we see and treat. Grade 4s tend to have had a problem before their cruciate ruptures. So if we look at the stifle joint, we're going to start looking at the stabilizers of the joint. So if we look at a static position, we're looking at the collateral ligaments. And these are very much important when the joint is in extension. So we find that the medial collateral and lateral collateral are both taut when the joint is in extension. When you flex the joint, these tend to slacken, and therefore are less important as regards stability for the joint in the flex position. The other thing we're going to look at then are for static stabilizers are the cruciate ligaments. So they're going to sit within the joint and they stop cranial and caudal displacement. The third thing we're going to see then is the joint capsule. That helps to stabilize the joint. And the fourth thing we see is the menisci. So the presence of the menisci between the condyles help to make contact, help to provide some form of stability within the joint. Then if we look at the dynamic stabilizer of the stifle joint, we start to look at the muscles. And we're mainly looking at the hamstrings at the back. We're looking at the gastrocs at the back. But on the front, it's the extensor mechanism that's really important. So this is the quadriceps, the sartorius, the patella, the straight patellar ligament tendon, tibial tuberosity. So this mechanism is very important for that dynamic stabilization of the joint. So if we look at the extensor mechanism of the joint, this is going to be the quadriceps muscle and the sartorius muscle where it comes down and actually attaches onto the side of the patella on the medial aspect. Some people would talk in terms of the sartorius coming down further, which it does, but a part of it will attach to the patella, and that is quite important on that medial side for that medial attachment. It will tend to pull the patella medially as well. The patella, which is a sesamoid and a quadriceps mechanism, the trochlear groove we spoke about before, the strip patellar ligament tendon, and the tibial tuberosity itself down here in the front of the tibia, where it sits medially in patellar luxations. These diagrams are slightly confusing, but I suppose what we're looking at here is we're looking at the craniocaudal stability of the joint. And two parts of the extensor mechanism help with the craniocaudal stability. Number one is the femoropatellar joint itself. So the patella sitting within that trochlea will give you some stability in craniocaudal and medial lateral direction. Second thing is the action of the quadriceps. As you pull on the quadriceps, you pull through the patella, and this causes a pressure that moves down to the tibial tuberosity, which then pulls the tibia upward and backward. If we look at many of the different models that have looked at stifle flexion extension, there are two different ways. When Slocum looked at this, he started to talk in terms of that the force acting on the stifle, wanting to force the femur onto the tibia, was perpendicular to long or to the tibial plateau axis. When Tepich looked at this, he decided that in actual fact the force was almost parallel to the pull of the straight patellar ligament, which gave him the idea where he could look at his TTAs and changing that force, therefore stabilizing the knee. If you look at medial lateral stability, the patella sitting within the trochlea is probably the most important thing, because it's got the parapatellar fibre cartilages out either side, and they hug both ridges of the trochlea and help to stop it moving medially or laterally. So again, if we look back at the extensor mechanism, there's a number of studies that looked at this, and what they found was that the patellar trochlea act as a pulley system to optimize the function of the quadriceps during stifle extension. By moving the patella away from the axis of flexion extension in the stifle, the trochlea provides a lever arm to the quadriceps muscle, thus minimizing muscle contraction during extension. Any reduction in the trochlear leverage owing to patellar luxation results in a relative increase in the magnitude of the contractile forces necessary to produce stifle extension. Basically, what they're saying is, while the patella sits in the trochlea, you get a lever arm, L. If you let your patella slide around the side, as it does here, your lever arm gets shorter. If your lever arm is shorter, you need a bigger force to cause the stifle to extend. So basically, you need much more force by pulling here to make it extend than pulling here. By having it further at the front, it pulls and lifts the tibia up. By having it around the side, it's much more difficult, needs a greater force. So basically, in humans, they have actually done studies and have shown that by removing the patella itself, not changing the position, just removing the patella, you get an increased contractility required to extend the stifle of about 30%. So this whole mechanism is very important. The whole lever arm is important. The whole position of the patella is important for stability of the stifle and action of the stifle. The other part for stability of the stifle are the craniocrucid ligaments. So if we start looking at the craniocrucid ligament, we look at it here. It arises on the medial aspect of the medial femoral condyle, or the lateral femoral condyle, extends cranially, medially, and distally across the intercondylar fossa to attach to the cranial intercondyloid area of the tibia. The important thing here is to note there is no one point when we look at flexion of the stifle, we see that the cruciate tends to spiral and rotate on itself. And this gives rise to the concept of bands. So we have what we call the craniomedial band and the caudolateral band. What you find is that the cranial medial band, which runs from here to here, tends to flex in flexion, whereas the caudolateral band tends to be taut in both flexion and extension. So it doesn't tend to move. So we have what we call isometric points. So these are the points within the joint that don't move relative to each other at different points in time. Now, fortunately, in the stifle, these are not single points. These are a number of points, both proximally and distally, that move, that stay relatively stable relative to each other during different parts of motion. However, there's no single point that stays static relative to another during. And this is important when we start talking about how we're actually going to get stability. So if we could get two single points, we could put a suture from one point to the other, and it would act and function as a cruciate ligament, and everything would rotate around it. Because there's a number of points, because we end up with a line, this is less possible and much more difficult. And these are referred to as the isometric points, and these are the sort of points we're going to start talking about when we start talking about getting sutures to mimic the cranial cruciate ligament. So if we look at the functions of the cranial cruciate ligament, the first one is the limit overextension of the stifle. This picture, I think, has got to have made it to every orthopedic surgeon's lecture at some point, where this person has planted their foot, taken tackles right on the shoulder, knee has gone the wrong way. The only way that can happen is if both ligaments have snapped. This is likely to be a career-ending injury and potentially going to lead to serious problems in future life. But I suppose we all still play rugby, so it can't be that bad. Second thing you find is that the cranial cruciate ligament limits internal rotation of the tibia with respect to the femur. As you start to internally rotate the tibia, you find the two ligaments wrapped around each other, and they eventually come to a point where it will stop you. Like two ropes knotted together, it will eventually come to a limit, and that stops you. Then it unrotates again. The third thing is that it limits cranial draw. So we've got a lovely picture here of a cranially displaced tibia relative to the femur. This tibia should be back here. So what's happened is this cruciate is gone. It's allowed the whole thing to pop forward. So if we look at cranial cruciate ligament and medial patellar luxation, why do we get the two at the same time? Well, officially, the etiology is unknown. So we really cannot specifically say that there is a single one cause. It tends to be multifactorial. What we can say is that the medial patellar luxation appears to precede the cranial cruciate ligament. Now, you can occasionally get the opposite happening when you've ruptured the cranial cruciate ligament and stifle becomes so unstable that the patella can then luxate. That is rather unusual. It does appear that the medial patellar luxation precedes the cranial cruciate ligament. And we noticed that by looking at the different groupings we looked at before. The medial patellar luxation is present in the younger dogs, the less than mature adults, whereas the cranial cruciate ligament and medial patellar luxation was present in the older animals, 7 to 8 years of age more commonly. Loss of the action of the patella, in other words, with medial patellar luxation, increase the strain on the cranial cruciate ligament. So you get internal tibial rotation. Well, we know that for a fact. That's part of the abnormality we typically see with medial patellar luxation. The tibial tuberosity is medialized. That then internally rotates the tibia, and that also puts strain on the cranial cruciate ligament, which is trying to prevent that happening. We also get loss of the patella within the trochlea. We said that loses the extensor mechanism. Therefore, we're starting to see a cranial caudal instability causing more pressure on the cranial cruciate ligament. So two of the functions of the ligament come into play when the patella is luxated. Age and onset suggest that the cranial cruciate ligament injury is secondary. Occult MPL may be exacerbated by cranial cruciate ligament. Medial patellar luxation as a result of CCL treatment is seen occasionally. But cranial cruciate ligament can be present in all grades of medial patellar luxation, as we saw before. It's more likely in grade 4. In one study, then, 18 out of 37. There's the previous study we looked at before, which seems to suggest that you get it in all grades, where we got 4 out of 19 in grade 1s, 24 out of 120 grade twos, we had 21 out of 90 grade threes, and 18 of 37 grade fours. So basically, all grades maybe slightly increased presence in grade four, but then we see less grade fours. Radiographically, what do we see? Typically, as with medial patellar luxation and on its own, oftentimes we will see the changes consistent with the hip changes, so the retroversion, the increased angle of inclination of the femoral head and neck, the bowing of the distal femur, the lateral rotation, the hyperplastic medial condyle, increased size of the lateral condyle. Occasionally you'll see the patellar luxate, but don't be surprised if you don't see the patellar luxate, because oftentimes if these are less than grade four, once you anaesthetize the animal, tibia rotates back into its normal position and the patella will sit back in position. Occasionally you will see the changes in the tibia as well. You'll get the angulation proximally. You'll get the medialization of tibial tuberosity. You'll see the changes in the hock with the foot rotated inward, the calcaneus rotated outwards. Typically, you will see an effusion in the stifle on the lateral view, but you don't see much else. People do talk about having patella alta and patella badge, and that's got to do with the position of the patella, and we will little slide coming up in a minute to look at that, but oftentimes it's not an issue in most cases. The other thing to remember is osteoarthritis is likely to be present in all these joints. However, it tends to be more frequently present in both the medial patellar luxation and the cranial cruciate ligament disease, because we've got more inflammation going on. They tend to be slightly older animals, and we're likely to have cartilage erosion within this joint, therefore causing lots more ossified formation, lots more effusion, and lots more inflammation within the joint. So, we're going to start looking at surgery to treat these problems. And the traditional surgery for the medial patellar luxation centers around that quadriceps mechanism. The quadriceps mechanism is not aligned, therefore our aim is to realign it. And the most common way of doing that is some form of tibial tuberosity transposition. So basically we adjust the position of the tibial tuberosity to bring the patella in line with the trochlea. Second thing we will commonly do is we'll do a trochleoplasty. So we say this trochlea is too shallow, we will attempt to make this trochlea deeper. Typically, while we're in here, if we've got some cartilage erosion, some ulceration, we will start looking at treating that cartilage with foraging or micropicking of the ulcerated area to increase the blood flow. Ultimately, by realigning the mechanism, by repositioning the patella within the trochlea, this should relieve a lot of the pain and discomfort from that ulceration, and that in and of itself should be sufficient. By creating foraging or micropicking it, creating bleeding on the surface, we hope to create some fibrocartilage. It's not as good as hyaline cartilage, but at least it covers that subchondral bone exposure, helps to settle down the joint. Then we start looking at some soft tissue releases. So frequently, we will release the tie down on the medial retinaculum. So this is quite often referred to as a desmotomy. So we open up that medial joint capsule. It has been shown that if you extend that to include the sartorius attachment on the side of the patella, that you will get better outcomes. In one study that looked at reasons for failure or poor outcomes in medial patellar luxation, it found that if a sartorius release was performed, so releasing the sartorius from its attachment on the medial aspect of the patella, that the outcomes were better. And it's all got to do with the fact that this tissue is trying to pull the patella medially. So you want to release that medial pull. You want to allow the patella to sit in the groove and not be pulled out of the groove again. You want to look at tightening up the lateral retinaculum. So this quite often is called imbrication. So some people look at removing a section of the lateral retinaculum. Some people look at oversewing it just to tighten it all up. And some people then also talk about rectus femoris release. That comes from some people that looked at grade 1 patellar luxation, and they felt that there was just increased pressure on the patella, and a study that looked at what's called the Q angle, which is the angle of the patella to the rectus femoris. And they found that increasing Q angle increased the likelihood of patellar luxation. So people started looking at removing the attachment of the rectus femoris from the wing of the ilium up here, causing the muscle to slacken a little bit, stop the medial pull. So it, as well as the sartorius muscle, can be used. I have also come across people who look at elevating the quadriceps muscle from the femur. It seems a little bit too extensive and a bit too brutal, but it does help. Then we can come down to corrective osteotomies of the femur and or the tibia. And lastly, as a last resort, some people look at patellectomy. We're not going to be concentrating on these very much down here. We're going to very much stay up here at the top part first. So if we look at the trochlea, many ways of making this trochlea deeper. In the juvenile, less than 5-6 months of age, you can even just consider putting the patella back within the trochlea and allowing the trochlea to develop around the patella. And in many cases, that will help the patella to grow, or the trochlea to grow normally. However, that isn't the case in most of these dogs. We are looking at a mature dog. And the most common way of doing that is what's called the wedge recession sulcoplasty. Using an X-Acto saw, we cut a wedge, lifting out the central section of the trochlea, removing another slice here to make the groove deeper, and then sitting it back in. Now, a couple of things you've got to be careful for is make sure that the apex of your wedge sits in the apex of your second cut. Some people will even just use a runger's just to take off that point, just to let it sit in a little bit better, and try and get your patella to stay in that trochlea when you're finished. You're aiming to have approximately 50% of the patella within the trochlear groove on a lateral radiograph. You will find that doing a trochleoplasty in and of itself is not sufficient to make the patella stay within the groove. So the groove can be 5 foot deep. If, however, the patella is tended to be pulled medially, it will still come out. So you need to nearly always combine this with a tibial crest transposition to correct the alignment of the patella. I prefer what's called a block recession trochleoplasty. And this is published way back in 2000. I've been doing it for longer than that. But ultimately, what we look at doing is two parallel cuts and then using an osteotome to lift off the central section of the trochlea. We then deepen the area underneath the trochlea and put this whole block back in, giving us a much deeper groove. You can see here maybe 2 to 3 mil ridge here. And we preserve as much cartilage as possible. You can see this is what it looks like radiographically. This section was taken off, taken out, deepened underneath it, and put back in, giving us approximately 50% of the patella within the trochlear groove. We also went ahead then and did tibial crest transposition. Again, you can look at the parallel cuts here and here, and then the whole block is lifted out. The idea is to try and preserve as much cartilage as possible for contact between the patella and the trochlea to give a more normal trochlear groove. People say, well, should we do wedge, should we do block? I tend to do block because I like the block. I've always found it to be pretty good. I've always found it to work well for me. Many people find that the block is too difficult, especially in the smaller dogs. The osteotome doesn't work. They'll lose the section, whatever, and they want to use their wedge. The biggest problem for me is the fact that when you take the wedge out, you don't really deepen the trochlea proximally, which to me is where many of these patella will luxate. So when the leg extends, the patella rides up to here, goes over the trochlear ridge, and then slides down medially. With the block, at least you can make this area here much deeper. Not only that, but people even talk in terms of putting on a kind of a runoff, taking all the cartilage up here and shaving down the cortical bone to make the trochlea extend not from here to here, but to extend it from here up to about here, so that your patella sits in much better. If you look at cross-sectional views of the block versus the wedge, the block tends to be much wider, lets the patella sit in a lot better. The wedge, obviously you can make your wedge bigger, but you tend to find that you end up sitting up on the two points of the trochlear ridges. So my preference is a block resection, but wedges work fine. I would always tend to do blocks. It's what I'm used to. It's what I do all the time. You can find in the small dogs, oftentimes using a number 11 blade to cut your block out is useful. Beaver blades can be used occasionally. But yes, it's a bit of skill. Once you've mastered it, it's relatively easy. You can also use the bone you take out as a bone graft underneath your tibial tuberosity transposition when you come to do that. So we've deepened the groove. We've created an increased trochlea. We look up here. We can see that the patella is sitting 50% within the trochlea. We're quite happy with that. That's acceptable. Then we're looking at tibial crest transposition. So the first question is, how big should a tibial crest or tibial tuberosity be? Well, I used to always just move a little bit because the attachment was just here. I used to move a little bit of bone. And then I found that the smaller fragments tended to break. The second thing was, when you move a little bit of bone around the side, basically you soon run out of bone to reattach it to. So you have to put it back onto the cortical bone at the side. Since I started doing a lot more osteotomies, TTAs, I found myself making bigger and bigger tibial tuberosities, to the point now that my tibial tuberosity will be back at the anterior point of the stifle joint. I will be back as far as the tubular girdle, and where the tibial tuberosity attaches onto the medial tibial condyle. So I've got a big chunk of bone. I will cut it right down. I always intend to leave some attachment here distally so it doesn't disappear proximally or distally. However, I tend to find that if you try to leave too much bone down here, you won't be able to move your tibial tuberosity very much. And if you can move your tibial tuberosity, then that probably isn't holding that well. So I will tend to take a big tibial tuberosity in a large breed dog. That can be 18, 19 mils from the point of the tibial tuberosity to my incision site. That does two things. When we look at it, we move it over, we will have better bone-to-bone contact for a much further period, which means you can move it a long distance laterally and still keep it at the front part of the bone, not go around the side. Still have pins, bone to put the pins in, and that allows for better healing. Ultimately, how far do I move it? I move it as far as I have to. I will quite often look at a dog's leg conscious before I anesthetize it, decide I need to move that 5 mils, 6 mils, get in there, find I move it 5 or 6 mils, and the patella still pops straight back out again. So I will move it to such point as it stops popping out medially. Occasionally you will move it so far that it starts popping out laterally, and then you're going to make a compromise between the two. But you shift the tibial tuberosity. I will quite often just put a small pin down the side of the tibial tuberosity, temporarily stabilize it, then start internal and external rotate the tibia to see if the patella will stay within the trochlea. The joint will be still open at this point in time. I figure if the patella stays in place with the open joint, when I tighten up the joint and give it extra support, it'll stay in much better after that. So ultimately, how far do I move it? As far as is necessary without creating lateral patellar luxation. Next one is, how many pins do I use? So I've traditionally always put in two pins. People talk in terms of you need 2 points of fixation. And people say one big pin up in the proximal tibial tuberosity and leaving it attached distally, that's 2 points of fixation. And yes, I can't disagree with that. However, I tend to put two small pins up proximally. I think it holds it a lot better. And it's been proven with Garrett Archer's study, where he looked at the reason for complications. He found that that one pin was more likely to have a problem than two pins. The second he looked at was the angle of that pin. If you use a single pin, you need to angle it either transversely or proximally, because the pull of the muscle wants to flip the tibial tuberosity proximally. You need to have the pin working against that action. If you have a point in distally, then you'll tend to find that's more likely to be associated with a complication. If you use two pins, that doesn't seem to be an issue. So I tend to use two pins, and occasionally I'll use three, as in this case. I'll use small pins, just embed them through the tibial tuberosity into the tibia, and just bring them out the caudal aspect of the tibia. I do make sure they engage the caudal aspect of the tibia, but I don't want them sticking out too far. Then I will always put a tension band wire on an adult dog. If it's a juvenile dog, if it's a tibial tuberosity transposition, I will not put on a tension band wire, because obviously the effect of the tension band wire is to compress the tibial tuberosity onto the main part of the tibia and therefore increase healing in this osteotomy site. By doing that with a tibial crest avulsion, you will close that growth plate. And I have seen a tibial tuberosity sitting down here in the middle of the tibia because that happened. But in an adult dog, I will always put on tension band wire. It takes me 5 minutes. It increases my success, and I don't have a problem. Then we look at the extracapsular suture techniques. So basically, I will also release the medial tissue. So I will have the sartorius release. I will do a medial desmotomy. I will have open up the lateral aspect of the joint. When I close it up, I will put the patella back in place. I will imbricate the lateral retinaculum, and I will loosely tack the medial desmotomy and quadriceps muscle so that the soft tissue is pulling the patella back into position. If I have a cranial cruciate ligament injury, the simplest thing to do, if we choose to treat it, would be to put an extracapsular suture. And when we put that suture in, we are looking at placing this suture to restrict cranial displacement of the tibia. We've put the patella back in place, and that will automatically stop the tibia going forward a lot more. Second thing we're going to do is we put a lateral suture in here. These can be of nylon leader line, these can be of wire, all sorts of suture material being used. Some people use ligi fiber, whatever you're happy using. I oftentimes will put a knot on them, sometimes I will put a crimp on them. And what you will find is in many cases, you will put your tibial tuberosity, you would tend to put up here at somewhere close to the isometric points, which are in this spot here and this spot here. So that would be ideal. Because we find that we anchor it behind the lateral fibula, we tend to use that as a singular point. We can't change that. Therefore, we will tend to anchor it through a tibial tunnel just behind the osteotomy site. So here we go again. We're looking at getting this lateral suture in here. We drill a hole here in the tibia, proximal tibia, behind the osteotomy, up high, and getting close to our isometric points. This will stop some cranial displacement in the tibia. We realize that these sutures do not hold forever. They don't last. You can use proline if you wish. You can use some people use PDS, however, I think that won't last long enough and that'll lose strength too quickly. I tie them snugly. I don't tie them over tight. I don't try and internally rotate my tibia because I've already shifted my tibial tuberosity. So that is already, I've already moved my tibial tuberosity to help support the joint to stop the tibia internally rotating. So basically all I want to do is stop the cranial displacement of the tibia. We then do the soft tissue reconstruction thereafter. So basically this would be one of the most common ways of treating small dogs with medial patellar luxation and cranial cruciate ligament disease. And this is probably the most common way you will do it. Some people even suggest that just by replacing the patella, putting the patella back in the groove, by restoring the extensor mechanism, that in many cases will be sufficient to stabilize the knee in a cranial caudal direction. You could look at staging these and do one surgery now and coming back and doing a lateral suture later if you thought that was necessary. So you could do a stage procedure. However, I tend to do it all in one and it works quite well. We did talk before about this patella alta concept. So basically if your patella is riding up here, popping out of the groove, what you would do is when you do your tibial tuberosity transposition, you would move it down, move it distally so that it brings the patella back within your groove. You will naturally move the patella distally with your TTAs because ultimately by moving the tibial tuberosity forward, you also move it distally ever so slightly. So that creates a natural patella badger. So the other ways of looking at this are to consider the geometry of the stifle. So many of the ways of treating cruciate disease these days consider changing the geometry of the stifle so there's less need for a straight patella or for a cranial cruciate ligament. And that, a lot of it comes back to the work of Tepich and of Slocum. And again, we're coming back to this idea that the force in the stifle is parallel to the straight patellar ligament, or ideally should be. If you look at the studies that they have done, they started talking in terms of the crossover point. So when you look at the stifle in extension, you find that the crossover point is this 110 to 90 degree. So basically, at 90 degrees, the patella, or 90 degrees, the pressure goes from going on to the cranial cruciate ligament, meaning that the tibia wants to move forward, onto the caudal cruciate ligament, meaning the tibia wants to go backwards. 90 degrees was considered this crossover period between the tibial plateau and the straight patellar ligament. This is the basis of Slocum, or of Tepich's TTA, where he's going to take this angle here, so it is greater than 90, he's going to change that to 90 degrees, increasing the activation of the quadriceps mechanism, thereby stabilizing the stifle, causing the tibia to slop backwards and upwards and lock in position. And he does this by moving the tibial tuberosity forward to create this 90 degree angle. He suggested this should be done at 135 degrees. However, we all know that in many cases, getting this accurate is very, very difficult. But what he did show, that when you did move the tibia forward, that you moved this line downward, and therefore the crossover point was much further back, and therefore the tibia didn't tend to go forward but tended to sit backwards. So this was the basis of his TTA. However, Slocum's thought had been, well, if this slope of the tibial plateau was backwards, then if we change the slope around to about 6 degrees, which is what it is in people, that we eliminate cranial tibial thrust. And that's been pretty well accepted. Numerous studies have looked at it, and it does suggest that when that tibia rotates around, if this tibial plateau is relatively flat, the bones sit one on the other and the tibia doesn't displace cranially. Tepich then looked at both and said, well, hang on a second. If you rotate your tibial plateau around, you're also changing this angle between the straight patellar ligament and the tibial plateau to less than 90 at 6 degrees. Therefore, they're both achieving the same thing by doing it in different ways. So the TTA moves the tibial tuberosity forward to create this 90 degree angle. The TPLO rotates the plateau down to meet the force, therefore creating this 90 degrees. So basically, the concept would be that by creating a 90 degree angle between the pull of the straight patellar ligament and the quadriceps mechanism and the tibia, you then stop cranial tibial thrust. I think most people would agree it seems to work. So if we look at the TTA, what can we do with the TTA? Well, typically we measure this by using the common tangent method. So we originally started looking at the tibial plateau, but found that the tibial plateau was so variable and it was so hard to define, because one condyle slopes distally, one stands up proximally, the book curved, so you couldn't ever get a defined line that would reflect the tibial plateau. Therefore, they started looking at the common tangent technique. So you looked at a circle to encompass the femoral condyles, a circle to encompass the tibial plateau. You look at the point between the two of those, and that then gives you your common tangent, which is this line here. You then look at creating the straight patellar ligament at right angles to the common tangent. Okay, so you draw these two lines parallel to each other. This will give you 90 degrees here. You now measure the advancement required to move your tibial tuberosity to that point. What you will find is, if you look at this here, the measurement from the actual point to the line is one measure. However, when you cut the bone and you move the bone, it actually becomes a much bigger line. Why? Because we tend to put our cage up high. If we were to put a cage here directly behind where the advancement is required, then we would need just a simple advancement. When we start to put a cage up much higher, we've got a much bigger area to fill in. So therefore, we quite often tend to measure after we've advanced the tibial tuberosity to decide how big a cage we should put in. So once you put your cage in, you've advanced your tibial tuberosity, you have then treated your cruciate ligament. However, we now also have mediopatellar luxation. So how can we treat that? So you can look at your assessment and you will then say, well, we need to shift this tibial tuberosity laterally. Now, we put our plate and our cage medially. So what the way to do this was, we came up with spacers. So we would then put one of these spacers, a 2 mil, a 4 mil, or 6 mil spacer, routinely provided, underneath the cranial ear of the cage and put the screw through it. This then lateralizes the whole tibial tuberosity. Now, you've got to be careful because you have to have bent your plate beforehand to allow this to happen. And what you will find is that you will then come back and you may well have to bend the plate ever so slightly more again to get it to go over a little bit further. Another paper produced by Russell Yeadon and Noel Fitzpatrick looked at doing this and what they called the transposition of the tibial tuberosity advancement. And basically, what you did was they not only put washers underneath the cranial ear of the cage, but they also recessed the caudal ear of the cage. So they literally cut out some bone back here for the caudal screw so that the cage sat deeper and the screw went into this recessed section. So you can do either or both on the same dog to make the tibial tuberosity go laterally. The one thing you must ensure, though, is that your cage goes as far as the far cortex on the transposed tibial tuberosity. If you look at Russell Yeadon's paper, he had 39 stifles and 32 dogs. 17 had complete ruptures of the cranial cruciate, 22 had partial, and the weight range was from 6 kilos to 51 kilos. 17 were grade 2 patellar luxations, 19 were grade 3, and 3 were grade 4. They all had sulcoplasty, and they had complications in 11 out of 39. They had 4 reluxations, they had 2 infections, 4 wound infections, a wound breakdown, and 1 late meniscal injury. Basically, at 6 months, 35 of the 39 dogs were considered sound, and 4 had been lost to follow-up. They did query whether they, in doing this procedure, they brought the patella down low and created a patella badge. It didn't seem to be a clinical problem. So this is medializing the tibial tuberosity with a TTA. So if you look here on this x-ray, you can see that the plate that's on the side of the tibial plateau or tibial tuberosity is much more medialized. You can see the cage sticks out a lot further here. Why? Because you want it to be behind all that tibial tuberosity. So you want that tibial tuberosity to be sitting onto something solid. You don't want it rolling around the edge of the cage. The cages are designed with quite a big angle, quite a big slope on them. So that does mean that you tend to get away with it pretty much. Again, a case where we're looking at patellar luxation and we are looking at tibial tuberosity or a tibial tuberosity advancement procedure with lateralization. Okay, so we've moved it from, we should be starting here to over starting about here. So we've moved it a good 5-6 mils just to try and keep the patella in alignment. Again, we have got the patella sitting within the groove, holding within the groove. There is a paper that looks at the traditional tibial crest transposition with the lateral suture, which is, and they compared it to the tibial tuberosity advancement with lateralization. They had 72 stifles and 66 dogs. The grades of patellar luxation were reasonably normal, mainly twos and threes. 32 dogs had the tibial tuberosity transposition with the extracapsular suture, of which 19 of the 32 had an excellent outcome, 5 had a good outcome, 7 were fair, and 1 had a poor outcome. Complications were as high as 46.5%. And when they compared them to the complications with the tibial tuberosity advancement lateralization, there was 2.7 times more likely to have a complication with the extracapsular suture than the tibial tuberosity advancement. There was 40 dogs had the tibial tuberosity advancement, 27 had excellent outcome, 11 were good, 2 were fair. Complications were only 17.5%. 8 of those 40 did have a reluxation. So I think this is the issue here, is that when you do something like this, when you're making one procedure cover two different combinations, you tend to compromise yourself on one. With the tibial crest transposition, you mainly focus on shifting the tibial tuberosity to make the patella stay in the groove. When you're doing the TTA transposition, you are focused on the advancement, and then you lateralize as the secondary component. You may well not lateralize it enough. You may lateralize it enough so that when you rehab these and get the muscle mass back in the leg, the patella stay in and don't require a second surgery. But basically, you will still find that in these dogs, the sulcoplasty was still important. They had poorer outcomes if they didn't have sulcoplasty. So you do require a sulcoplasty, as in here. And I would also do a sulcoplasty when I'm doing a TTT, or TTA. So you can combine. Another combination of tibial tuberosity lateralization and advancement, it was proposed by Montavon, where he actually cuts his tibial tuberosity. Again, he cuts it fairly far back, but then he cuts it obliquely. So that when you actually lateralize the fragment, you get advancement at the same time. So this is the traditional lateralize it. The further back you are, the more bone-on-bone contact you're going to get up here for your reattachment to get the heel back on. Whereas if you look at the oblique cut, when you lateralize that, you also advance at the same time. You can achieve 3, 4, 5 mils, even up to 6, 7 mils of advancement and 6 or 7 mils of lateralization at the same time. The problem with it, again, can often be that the obliquity of the cut is difficult to define before you actually make it. And if your cut is not oblique enough, you're not going to get enough advancement, or you're not going to get enough lateralization. You cut from caudomedially to craniolateral. You can make that angle as steep or as far as you want. Remember that as you move it laterally, you will also advance it. The other important thing here is that it helps to not twist your straight patellar ligament, because in the past, when you took your tibial tuberosity off and you moved it around the side, you found that rotated your straight patellar ligament, and that in and of itself can lead to further luxation and more complications. By doing it this way, you lateralize in advance. These days, this osteotomy would most likely be back here. So you'd have a much bigger piece of bone, you'd have more bone-to-bone contact, and less likely to cause the rotation. So again, when you look at these, basically we've lateralized it 6 mils, so we've taken it from here and we've moved it to there. So we've lateralized that about 6 mils. We've also advanced it 6 mils. Now it's very hard to see these advancements because obviously you get an oblique cut. So you can see there's a line here and there's a line here. So basically that decreased density in between is the oblique cut, and you then slide it on that to try and get your advancement. So what you tend to find yourself having to do is measure from this point here to this point here on a true lateral radiograph and compare them afterwards. You will also notice that we've done a block recession here. So we've done a trochleoplasty to create that deepened groove for the patella to sit within the trochlea. So if you look here, the patella is sitting very prominent. Here, it's sitting within the groove. We've also created slight badger. We've brought it down from that position to slightly lower. But this is a relatively simple technique that can easily be performed. Now we're going to look at the other major component, which is the tibial plateau leveling osteotomy, or TPLO. Many of you will do this, many of you won't. Again, some people say, oh, is this a referral procedure? No, it's not. I mean, I think there are some people who are happy to do them, there's some people not happy to do them. Again, we're looking at, we measured the tibial plateau on the basis of the way Slocum described it, by the cranial aspect of the tibial plateau, the caudal aspect of the tibial plateau, a line connecting the two, a line for the intertubercular eminences down to the center of the trochlear curvature on the distal tibia, and then we measure the angle. We then change this angle to make this less than 6 degrees. We go in, we do all our measurements, we decide our saw blade, we're going to look at a circular cut, we put our jig on, so we put a pin approximately, pin distally, we make our cut, we then rotate the tibia. Once we've rotated to the point we want, because it's pre-measured, we insert a pin to hold the tibial tuberosity and fragment together. We apply a plate. Most people use locking plates these days. Cinti's locking plate is very good. The screws generally remain safe, lock tight, give us good stability, and these dogs do very, very well. The most common way of dealing with the patellar luxation when you're doing a TPLO is to take off the tibial tuberosity and move it. So you do your TPLO as you would, you then take off your tibial tuberosity as you normally would, and you then lateralize it, reattaching with a couple of K-wires and a figure of eight tension band wire. So you're just combining the two procedures to create to treat both the medial patellar luxation and to treat the tibial plateau increased angle. You can also combine it with a sulcoplasty. This was reported by Leonard et al, and they looked at combining this, and they did 15 stifles and 11 dogs. You'll note that the size of these dogs, these tended to be larger dogs. They didn't tend to do this in small dogs. I think it tends to be considered quite difficult to do this in small dogs, and most people are happy just to do the tibial crest transposition and lateral suture in the small dogs, but in the larger breed dogs, they tend to be much more worried about it. Again, your grade of patellar luxations were pretty much as you would expect, grade 2s, 3s, 1 grade 4, 1 was ungraded. 6 had a femoral osteotomy to correct angulation of the distal femoral. I don't think most people do those anymore. 8 had sulcoplasties. 50% did show up patellar thickening. Afterwards, 2 were lost to follow-up. 1 of the 13 that were seen for post-operative care had some pain, but no complications were seen by 8 weeks. So the follow-up was very short, but it is published out there. It is a recognized technique. It works in most people's hands. If you're comfortable with your TPLO, if you're comfortable with your TPLO plate, so you can see up here, by using the locking plate, your screws come out exactly where you want them to come out. This is quite a good technique and works very well. Another TPLO technique that's been described is a lot more complex. And what you're looking to do is, not only are you going to do your TPLO, but you're also going to then rotate the proximal fragment so that your tibia rolls back round. So you're shifting your whole tibia, not just the tibial transposition, you're shifting the whole tibia around on this caudal fragment. So you're kind of leaving the stifle joint, moving the rest of the leg. You're looking at a number of different rotations to happen here. So you're looking at the patella mechanism alignment. So you can shift your whole proximal tibia, your tibial tuberosity and attached tibia, 2 to 3 mils laterally. You're then looking at your tibial varus, so you can actually tilt this up to correct tibial varus here. So you're tilting up here to open up this area, so you're bringing this up and closing this down, which corrects varus. And then the third thing you're doing is you're correcting your tibial plateau angle. This does require you to contour the plate, the TPLO plate, significantly. And you can contour up to about 30 degrees reasonably safely. Greater than that becomes very, very difficult. This has been published in 13 stifles, 12 dogs. Again, you're looking at larger dogs. You're looking at 30 to 50 kilos. In one case, there was implant failure, one had infection, one had tibial fracture, and 2 had wound issues. The lameness scores improved from 3.5 to 0.3 at 6 months. So they had significant improvement. You can see, you can also put in a block recession trochleoplasty up here. What you will see, it looks like a standard TPLO, but the difference is you can see there's an opening of the angle in here. So instead of that TPLO being bone and bone contact, you tend to find that opens up a little bit as you try to correct both the varus and that craniocaudal rotation. I think this is quite a complex thing to do. Most people would prefer to do TPLO as is and add the tibial tuberosity transposition to it. Getting towards the end now, we can do a TPLO by closing wedge osteotomy, fairly standard. You can also use that to correct varus and valgus at the same time. So you would tend to correct it here by taking a wedge osteotomy out of there, changing your wedge, closing it down. You can also rotate the proximal fragment somewhat, and that works in some cases. Again, I would tend to do a resection trochleoplasty as well, as there, to try and get the patella to stay within the groove. More recently, people started talking about patella groove replacements and using this for patella luxation. Again, it's a titanium plate that fits on the bone. You get a press fit groove that clips onto that, stays in place. It's got a diamond coating for low friction. However, this does not necessarily change the tracking of your tibia, of your rectus femoris, and you will also need to do a tibial crest transposition at the same time, or you can put on your, you can move the groove to suit the position of the tibial mechanism. So that can work. However, if you start getting more complex with this and you're looking to treat a cruciate ligament at the same time, you then have to look at putting the TTA in there or a lateral suture. I tend to just use the patellar groove replacements for grade 4 medial patellar luxation so we don't have a groove, or a revision surgery where somebody's irreparably damaged the trochlea. So you can combine it with TTA. There is only one paper looking at patellar groove replacement, of which 6 of the 35 had both conditions. They treated 4 with TPLO in the PGR, 1 with a TTA in the PGR, and 1 with an extracapsular suture. The outcomes didn't define cranial cruciate and medial patellar luxation together. Other options, you can look at your TTOs, your TTAs, but this is one that people might be tempted by, the ridge stop. Well, the ridge stop, to me, I'm not a big fan. As I say, you can make the ridge as big as you want, but until you shift your tibial tuberosity, you're not going to do an awful lot. So, yes, do a ridge stop, do tibial crest transposition, maybe put in a lateral suture. I have seen somebody do a ridge stop and tibial crest transposition and followed up with an MMP, a stage procedure. The problem with the MMP is you really will struggle to lateralize that tibial tuberosity at the same time you put the wedge in. So I don't think that's amenable. And personally, I wouldn't do it, but I'm sure somebody will find an ingenious way of doing it. So that's the end of our presentation for now. Sorry, everyone, slightly over. Any questions at the present moment in time? Okay, so no questions at this stage, so obviously it's as clear as mud. Basically, to sum up, I tend to do tibial crest transposition and lateral suture in small dogs. Oftentimes, in the very small dogs, I will just do a tibial crest transposition, repair the medial patellar luxation, and leave the cruciate alone, provided I treat the meniscal injury if it's present. The other option you would potentially do would be just putting a lateral suture as well. You could stage the procedures, correct the medial patellar luxation. If it's not doing well, go back in and put a lateral suture as the other option. When I get to larger breed dogs and I'm treating the cranial cruciate ligament as an entity in its own right, I will tend to use the TTA with lateralization. But TPLOs are fine as well. Okay, thank you very much for your attention. Bye.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Thurlock for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.